This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi,
my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Scott McWilliams. How are you, Scott?
G'day, mate. I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. Last week we were talking a bit about the history of McWilliams and we got up to about the 1950s, I think, didn't we?
Oh, there's a lot of history, so I could talk all day, really.
But we've just seen the burgeoning of still wines in Australia, or as winemakers were coming back from Europe and winemakers were sort of copying that styles, maybe slightly copying the names as well, perhaps Burgundies and Bordeaux and Clarets and all that sort of thing. If you look at McWilliams these days, you're quite a big company with lots of different sites as well. Can we roll forward? When did things start expanding into different areas?
So the Australian public started to appreciate still wine versus fortified wines, I would say more towards the 70s and 80s, and then in the early 80s, Chardonnay became a big thing. Then, you know, roll forward through to the late 90s when New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc started to become a big thing, which was a big thing in Australia.
Yeah, still a big thing, even though the Aussie winemakers don't like
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, yeah. So McWilliams Wines has, in the last 50 years, had this amazing roller coaster from coming out of fortified wines, going into the Hunter Valley as being one of our Mount Pleasant property from the Hunter Valley, mm-hmm. Being a big part of our portfolio. And then more recently, Chris, we've been doing a lot with cool climate viticulture. And now we're not down south, so we're not that cool. Yeah, so McWilliams Wines is not in the southern part of Australia as such. However, the Great Dividing Range, which is the mountain range that runs north-south, just on the eastern seaboard area there, that gives us a lot of high-altitude viticultural mm-hmm. options. And McWilliams Wines has been championing a lot of these higher altitude. And that's a lot of New South Wales regions. There's regions in the Great Dividing Range which we've probably never heard of, which are fantastic grape-growing regions. They're only fairly new.
We've been to Orange. I went out to Orange quite a few years ago, and we interviewed Shaw.
Philip Shaw Wines Philip is probably you're there. Thinking of. And so there's regions like Orange, but just if you go further south from Orange along the same mountain range, you get to the Hilltops, which mm-hmm. is something that my family has been a big pioneer of. There's other regions like one called Tumbarumba.
Tumbarumba, it sounds like a drum from a kiddie's playground.
Well, or a dance, yeah. but the Tumbarumba region's one of my favourites. It sits just beneath the snow line. And so the vineyards are up around, up over 800 metres. And so very cool climate. And we in fact, take about half that region's fruit.
Between what you grow and what you buy?
Well, we don't grow anything in Tumbarumba, but we do buy. In the Hilltops, we do grow a lot of our own. We've mm-hmm. got a vineyard there. We were one of the first to put in a large vineyard in the Hilltops. And then there's also the Canberra district. So the city of Canberra, which is our capital, there's a very fast-emerging viticultural and winemaking scene that's coming from the Canberra district. And we do our own Canberra wine. And so New South Wales, it's a little known fact that is the oldest wine producing state of Australia. South Australia takes a lot of the glory. And it is about 50% of the industry. But New South Wales is the oldest viticultural region. Hunter Valley is still the oldest in production today. And that's where we've got our famous Mount Pleasant estate. Mm-hmm. But little known is that the fact that we have all these high altitude viticultural regions within New South Wales. And so we're making very cool climate wines, which are very on trend at the moment.
Well, the freshness, the acidity you get from cooler climate is people do like a nice crisp wine at the moment.
That's true. And reds, you know, I would say that the biggest, boldest red that we do in our business from a New South Wales region is still more of a medium-bodied style.
Yeah.
You know, gone, I think, I hope, are the days of over-the-top wines. Yeah, there's a very famous American wine critic who was driving a lot of wine styles for too long. And now we've passed that, and we're now making wines that I call new age. So I define this to people. There's old world, the old world wine.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the new world. And I think we all know the difference between the old world and the new world.
Wow. Not, they sort of merged into each other, really.
Well, this is what I call new age.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So we're not getting all happy on us.
No, well, strains, I call it strains, wines. And McWilliams, what we're doing with the McWilliams brand is we're making wines that are new age. So it's sort of somewhere in between. It's that blend of, you know, it's just some new world flavors, but it's not just big jam bombs and big alcohols. We're in fact making reds of medium body intensity, whites showing minerality. And so we're sort of starting to come back to the old world in style, but with the new world flavor profile.
Mm-hmm.
We're just, winemakers, I believe, have learnt that bigger is not best.
No, it has its place.
It has its place, that's sure. And you won't see so many Chardonnays that are coming out with huge malo or buttery flavours. And then they're not over-oaked anymore.
No, the old days of getting hit around the head with an Aussie cricket bat because you've had a Chardonnay.
That's right. So McWilliams wines are very much in full swing in those complex wines through sophistication coming from cool climate viticulture through high altitude.
Yeah, okay. There is a move in Australia to, because some there've been talk about the inland areas being an unsustainable wine region, whether that's through water shortages or, you know, just competition for water, etc. And there, people talk a lot about the move to the coast for that cooler climates. Is that sort of part of that move for you guys into New South Wales, hilltops and?
The move into those regions was more for flavour profile.
Mm-hmm.
It's more cost effective to grow grapes in the Riverina, still is and probably will be for a very long time.
More profitable?
Depending on how much you can get for your bottle of wine at the shelf. You know, I've been here visiting the UK looking at shelf positioning on certain products, and I'm just shake my head and wonder how some people are making any money. It's tough. Really tough. So when you have high overhead viticultural practices, you have a different market you're aiming at. Mm. But when you're a big producer, and McWilliams Wines, I would call us a medium-sized producer, one of the bigger family producers, but you know, we got to duke it out with the big boys, you know. And so we've got to make sure that what's in our bottle is paying homage to our legacy and our name for a start. Being a family company with a very good reputation within Australia, and we've been in the UK for a long time as well, and other parts of the world, in fact. So McWilliams is a very reputable name. Our angle is making sure that we over deliver on a price point, and we have to. Otherwise, you know, it's just fighting it out against the big guys, and the big guys have got big guns and big, you know, muscle. So what's our point of difference? And it's that we've got family passion, and that comes through in our winemaking.
Okay. Just when did you guys start exporting wines?
You know, there is a record of our first export coming to the UK in 1935. Yeah, and that would have been bulk wine in barrels.
Yeah.
And it would have been a fortified wine.
Yeah.
And that's all the information that we have.
Okay. And when did you really start doing it as a key party business?
Really, the 70s was a good start for us. There was a man called John Avery from
Bristol.
Yeah, he started Avery's in Bristol. And so he was one of the first Brits to come down to Australia and look for Aussie wines to bring back to the UK. And there's a very famous photo of him standing in front of a stack of McWilliams Mount Pleasant wines at Avery's in the Bristol store. And so he's been recognized as being, you know, probably the father of the success of Australian wine in the UK. And then you've got the likes of Len Evans and Hazel Murphy. Hazel was working for one of the Australian offices that was dealing with wine in particular, and Len was a industry icon, and they sort of brought the sunshine in a glass over to the UK and you know, brought a lot of what are today English MWs out to Australia. And so it was really the 80s and the 90s that things started flowing for the industry in general. And that was the case for McWilliams wines too.
Just before we close up, just want to touch on a style of wine that we were talking earlier and you're saying was sort of led by you guys. It's the Riverina Tritus styles of wines.
Yes.
Do you want to just tell us about that? Because to be honest, I'll be absolutely straight up and down, I've actually never had one.
Okay.
Because you don't, they're not common in the UK. I'm sure I could go, if I really want to, I'd go hunting, I could find one, but I've never actually had one. So I know people talk about it them a lot. They get a good reputation. So what? Give me a quick history and a bit about the wines.
Absolutely, because we, McWilliams is a pioneer of the style. And my great uncle, Glenn McWilliam, he traveled in the 50s. He traveled over to France and went to the Sauternes region,
mm-hmm.
and got to experience what it was, what the Botrytis infection was for a start, and what it could do for wine style. So one day, it was vintage 1958. He lived just next door to the winery, and he had to walk through one of the blocks of grapes to get through to the winery, and that happened to be the grape variety was Pedro Ximénez, which is
For sherry.
Yes, correct. We were using it for sherry production back then.
Very sweet. Do you dry it out like they're doing Jerez?
Not quite. Okay. But Glenn, he had walked through the vineyard. It was obviously a wet year, and so that block was scheduled to be picked that day, and he walked through the vineyard from his home to the winery, and he could smell a smell that he recognized. And this smell was the smell of Botrytis. And so he had been to the Sauternes region and he recognized this smell. And he then said to the production team, "Don't pick that block. I want to see what it does." And so it was a trial.
Okay. Because, of course, you can always turn it into spirit if it didn't work.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah. Experiments back then, if they went wrong, we had an outlet to get rid of them. But anyway, he generated a wine called the McWilliams 1958 Pedro Ximénez. And it was labeled Sauternes, and because that's how it was done back then.
Yeah.
And he has been credited as producing the first intentional Botrytized wine.
Yeah.
And today, the Riverina is a big producer of what we call the dessert wine, or the sticky, or Botrytis Sem. Okay. Semillon is the key variety that is used.
Yeah.
And the style, I would say it's dissimilar to Sauternes. It's dissimilar to a German TBA.
Trockenberry Nassleser.
Yeah. Sorry, it's dissimilar to a Canadian ice wine. They tend to be very, the Riverina, Botrytis Semillons, and ours as well, tend to be very sweet, like heavy okay. sweet.
What, just because the acidity is quite low, your pH?
No, in fact, the acidity on them is quite high because they're acidified quite heavily.
Oh, okay.
But they're just picked with super concentration.
Yeah.
In fact, it is one of the hardest wines I've ever had to make, and that's purely because of the handling of the fruit. I mean, you look at this bunch of grapes that's been extended maturation or been hanging on the vine, late pick, and it's got this Botrytis infection, which, you know, you wouldn't eat a moldy loaf of bread, would you? Yeah. I mean, this is what these grapes look like. You wouldn't put them near your mouth, but gosh, they make the most amazing wine.
Riverina does produce these wines regularly. It's not like a one-off type of thing. So where do you get, normally in Sauternes, you get sort of misty mornings from the rivers, all the sort of feed rivers into the Gironde and the Garonne and all that sort of stuff. Where do you get that humidity to encourage Botrytis in Riverina? Because you think of Riverina as inland, dry, arid type of climate.
Correct. And it's it takes a little bit of understanding to realize that humid vineyard viticultural regions aren't the best for making that style, and it's purely because it's the Botrytis rot is in a humid area like the Hunter Valley, for instance. You could really struggle to make one because there's the other rots that will take over, like black rot. So the Botrytis is called the noble rot,
yeah.
So it's the good one, And in places like the Riverina, where it is a little drier, you can induce the good fungus without the bad ones to get the desired result.
And how do you do that?
So a little while back, there was ample water, the availability of water coming from the Murrumbidgee River for the irrigation area. Is allowed for flood irrigation in the vineyards.
Okay.
And so you'd get the evaporation of the water in the vineyard, creating in the canopy a meter above it, that sort of humid atmosphere, but then you'd get the drying winds. So it became the perfect place for growing that that botrytis infection on the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Riverina is the flagship wines from the Riverina. Arguably would have to be the Botrytis Semillons.
Okay. So does that mean, what about now? Because Australia's moved to drip irrigation, haven't they? So do you still get the Botrytis, or how do they encourage it now?
Yeah, the use of flood irrigation is less and less these days as water becomes, you know...
more valuable.
A lot more valuable.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are still growers who are able to get sufficient, infection. But to be honest, Chris, the style of wine is not a huge volume driver, especially not for McWilliams wines.
Yeah,
I know De Bortley still do a big volume, but the other wine producers, it's not a massive volume drive.
Okay, so it's just a premium wine that you guys produce.
That's right.
But it's not, because you can't make it because of the cost of the water.
Yeah, it is one of the hardest wines to make because it's so super sweet. The juice is really quite thick. It's almost, if you were to dilute honey 1 to 2 sort of thing, you're getting that level of viscosity and sugar content, so it's really thick. And so it really is hard to get the fermentation to initiate.
What does it ferment to typically?
We typically stop the fermentation with a desired level of residual sugar. And we end up with a product that could be about 10% alcohol to anywhere to 12% alcohol.
Okay.
But with a large amount of grape sugars still there.
So, because Sauternes is normally sort of 13 to 14% alcohol, isn't it? So you're sort of quite a notch below that in terms of the alcohol level.
Yes, and it will vary a bit. And also we get a lot more colour in the product. So the whereas a Sauternes would still be a sort of a paler colour.
Well, they get quite golden over time. But
they do over time, but ours go more golden and orangey in a shorter time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there any other sort of premium wines we haven't talked about?
Look, I think to touch on what's happening in Australia at the moment, what's on trend at the moment is alternate varieties. You know, we're talking Mediterranean varieties. There's a lot more science and a lot of smarter decisions being made as to what to grow where. And so we're seeing premium wines coming out made from Tempranillo, Fiano, Sagrantino, Vermentino. The Mediterranean varieties are being planted to suit the Australian climate.
Yeah.
And it is warming up. And, vintage conditions are changing rapidly, so we have to evolve our industry to take that on. And you see a lot of fruit being grown in Tasmania, a lot of warm regions that have water restrictions at times, having to be smarter with the drip irrigation, as you mentioned before. There's just better and smarter ways of making the product and also keeping costs down. That's a real struggle. The industry is so much about overheads, costs, routes to market, whilst maintaining wine style, evolving wine style. There's just so much to it, Chris. It's absolutely fascinating, and I probably wouldn't wish to do anything else.
Excellent. All right then, Scott. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Cheers.